Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle. Well, I learned something new about Japanese sake over the weekend.
Okay, that you can only drink so much of it?
I already learned that. went to a brewery for the first time, and Japanese sake is brewed, not distilled, with my father-in-law and my uncle-in-law. And, it was a pretty good deal, like all you can drink. And my uncle-in-law certainly took advantage of that.
Right.
But then I found out on every label there is two percentages. One of them is the alcohol content. It's usually around 20%, but sometimes it'd be 15. Sometimes it'd be, I think the highest we saw there was 27.
Okay.
And there's another percentage. I didn't know what the other percentage was. I actually didn't notice that there was two percentages before.
Which shows you how much you drank.
Yeah. And it is how polished the rice is. And it goes from genshu, or brown rice, down to the lowest I saw was 39%.
Wow.
Yeah, so they polished away over 60% of the rice.
Right, that's...
Or the grain, rice grain.
That's a lot.
So I didn't know that. So.
Yeah, I did not know that either. But you were saying that the less polished rice had a more distinct taste?
Well, I ended up buying two extremes. One, what they were calling like nama, or fresh.
Mm.
It's made from brown rice. And they were ladling it out of a wooden bucket just to kind of emphasize how ghetto it was, I guess. But I tasted that, and it's hard to describe. It tastes...
Like it came out of a wooden bucket.
Yeah. It tasted good, but it tasted like Japanese sake, kind of like a real distinctive, definitive taste. So if you wanted somebody to try sake, and not try it and just like it, but try it and appreciate how it's different from, let's say, wine, or this is what you would give them.
Hmm.
I bought the ghetto one, the brown rice one, for my parents who are coming next month, and then try it.
Well, we see where your priorities are.
Yeah, there you go. But like I said, that tastes like Nihonshu.
Right. Well, I meant to do the same thing when my family shows up. Then it's like, okay, here, you guys get the ghetto stuff.
Yeah.
And
the one cup Ozake, yeah. There you go. Why is it in a little jar?
Yeah.
Or how about the ones in the little drink boxes?
Yeah, those are hilarious.
Why is this in a tiny Tetra Pak? Yeah.
That's what I'll get them, yeah. Here you go. What's this? Alcohol? No, that's a juice box, yeah.
But in big gaming news, is Savage Worlds and Rifts will combine to form Savage Rifts.
Right. Trademark. I'm sure that's been trademarked.
Or just a trademark.
Yeah.
So people who don't know Kevin, although it seems to be everywhere, Kevin Tsumbeda has licensed Rifts to Pinnacle Entertainment, the makers of Savage Worlds, and they're expecting to release the core book by Christmas.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised because, I mean, I've never played Rifts, and as everybody who listens to the podcast knows, Savage Worlds isn't, our favorite system, but I'd seen on, Twitter and Google+ and Facebook that there was something in the works at Palladium Games, and that there was, hints that for the first time in like 20 years, they were going to license a product to a company other than Palladium. And there was all kinds of speculation about what system it would be. And of course, people were chiming in with what systems they hoped it would be. And and then fairly shortly after I saw that, like the very next day, today, I saw the announcement that, hey, it's Savage Worlds. And Savage Worlds is going to produce a version of Rifts. But that doesn't mean Palladium is going to stop making Rifts books. They're going to continue on. So it's not like one is replacing the other. I mean, you're still going to have both. Of course, I'm sure Pinnacle Entertainment is waiting to see how well a Savage Worlds Rifts book sells before they kind of go on and make others. But it's not as if either games don't have material to use in-game.
Yeah, we were a little surprised that it was Savage Worlds. We talked about it yesterday, and Savage Worlds did come up, but we didn't think that was the best choice.
Hmm.
But it is the choice, so it doesn't matter what we think.
Right. So why are you listening to us?
Yeah. I can see taking a while to get that core book down, because that's going to really establish how Rifts is going to play with a Savage World system.
Hmm.
And judging by comments online, people are pretty excited about it. And as you were saying prior to the podcast, both have pretty strong fan bases.
Right.
And not necessarily huge fan bases, but very loyal fan bases or rabid fan bases.
Hmm. So, loyal is nicer, yeah.
Yeah. So if you have people who really like the setting, and that's the classic knock on Rifts, is people love the setting, hate the system.
Mm.
And for whatever reason, a lot of people love the Savage World system. So they're saying, well, now I can finally play Rifts.
Right. And I've seen a lot of that. A lot of people are saying, looks like I'll finally give Rifts a try, or it looks like we can finally play Rifts. And like, yeah, as we were talking today, of course, didn't think it was going to be Savage Worlds. But, as you said, it kind of makes sense, given that both games have that very loyal fan base. And, yeah, I mean, this is kind of a, I think, kind of a win-win for both companies, because, as you said, people who have been interested in Rifts because of the setting but turned off because of the system, well, hey, Rifts is now getting a quote-unquote update to the rules that will encourage new people to play, which is what I think is going to happen based on the comments I've seen online. Maybe just because of the circles that I, you know, am kind of in, I haven't seen any Rifts players say, looks like it's time to check out this Savage World system. But apart from you, I don't really know any Rifts players.
Well, I'll talk to my group on Sunday to see if they're interested. I posted it on our little Facebook group, and it's got zero responses, so
right.
I guess I'm not too excited about it. But we'll find out if they'd be interested. But one thing about, you know, Rifts players, I mean, if they're big fans, they probably have most of the books or a significant chunk of books and just not that excited about converting over or buying new books. But yeah, for Savage Worlds, it's great. I mean, you know, we're really surprised that it is Savage Worlds because it is a very different system.
Okay.
So And once I got over that surprise, and you're kind of scratching your head wondering how is a game like Rifts going to play with the Savage World system, especially because a lot of the appeal of Rifts, I think, is some of the gadgets that you get.
Mm.
When I played Savage Worlds, it didn't seem to focus so much on the equipment. It was more on your abilities. But I guess it's a good thing because then you're going to get a different Rifts. You're not just going to get slightly different Rifts, like say if they converted it over to the hero system or the D20 system, you're going to get a very different type of game.
No, you were saying that earlier, and I think that's a really good point, because a very different kind of Rifts, you know, encourages people to play both games. You know, it kind of doesn't obsolete one or the other. And as I said, like, according to the press release or according to the announcement, yeah, Palladium's going to continue to produce Rifts books, and so the last thing they want to do is have everybody jump ship or assume that, you know, they're going to stop producing books and then switch over to Savage Worlds. But, yeah.
Yeah, and then once they get that Savage Worlds Rifts core book out, as you were saying before, I mean, there's a lot of different Savage Worlds books or settings that they can then use to say, hey, this is part of the Rifts world.
Mm, right.
So they instantly have sort of like a megaverse in Savage World, but then they also have, you know, the 30 plus world books that Rifts has, plus a source books and other things to just keep pumping up, like just pretty much just converting over to the Savage World system, maybe updates or some changes to the fluff and then pumping that out. But yeah, you could conceivably see somebody play, you know, I want to play Rifts Russia with the Rifts, the Palladium system, because it works better for me. But you know, when I play Phase World, I really like the Savage World system because I think it captures the pulp feel of Phase World. Phase World's not really pulp, but it's probably not the best example, but it was the one that came to mind. Dinosaur Swamp, maybe.
No, fair enough. I hadn't thought about actually jumping between the two systems, but you could do that, you know, with no problem, and then say, well, why do things like feel slightly different? Hey, Rifts, you know, which is the explanation for everything in Rifts.
But, well, you could have two different games going on. Not necessarily you would jump through a Rift and suddenly you're playing in the Savage World system, you know, but you could have your play group could alternate between the Savage Rifts and the regular Rifts.
Right, Savage Rifts, yeah.
Yeah.
No, and actually, I mean, I don't know how big the core book is going to be, but if Pinnacle is aiming to have a book by Christmas of this year, that's actually not a lot of time. I mean, considering how long it takes to make a book. So maybe they've already been working on it for a while, but you got to lop off at least like 2 months or maybe even like three for, you know, printing and delivery and stuff. So, yeah.
Well, maybe Symbeta requested some sort of proof of concept or a sample of what a Savage Worlds OCC would look like, how the combat would play. You know, he might have said, show me a Glitter Boy and show me a Cyber Knight in Savage Worlds. Let me see if this is a really good marriage.
Right.
So maybe they've already worked out some of the basics at Pinnacle. Or maybe they even did it just to see if they could do a good job with Rifts, because they obviously don't want to produce a book that's bad.
Right, right.
So saying, okay, let's hammer out, you know, the basic system and take some of these OCCs and see if we can make some decent characters, and how would we, you know, get people to play a rogue scientist and a glitter boy using our point buy system.
Right. But you're saying that, like, we didn't play all that much Savage Worlds, but, I mean, there were some templates available for what we played, and Rifts being such, like, a template-heavy system. Like, I could see that working instead of the usual method of, you know, having so many points to assign to your stats, and then having your stats cost so many, or you're having your skills cost so many points based on what stat they linked up. I could just see, pick these templates, and here is what you get in the Savage Worlds system, which, you know, I think would work fairly well. You know, it kind of set what your skills would be at. Otherwise they're just be at a d4. Maybe you get like a die step bonus to an attribute or two, and then you probably get a package of edges and hindrances all as one little, you know, OCC.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think it would have to do that, because Rifts is as much about its OCC as it is about its setting. So Rifts without a glitter boy or a cyber knight or a line walker, it just doesn't feel like Rifts. I mean, you could say to people, oh, just make whatever, and they come with, you know, a regular wizard, and you're like, sure.
But if nobody's riffs it up.
Yeah, riff it up a bit, dude. Push it back. Sorry, you're not 13 feet tall. Come on. So, where's your boom gun? And yeah, you would have to account for the balance, I suppose. I mean, you can't do Palladium-style balance.
Palladium-style balance, from what I've heard, is none.
It's different.
Different, the nice way of putting it.
Yeah.
Different.
Yeah. I'd be interested to see it, but as somebody who already has Rifts books, I'm not too excited about spending more money on Rifts. So it would really depend whether or not my playgroup switched over, of course. And I think a lot of people might be in that case.
Right.
Or might be in that boat.
Right. And how much of your non-enthusiasm is due to the fact that it's Savage Worlds?
Well, quite a bit, actually. I mean, if it had been... I've said this before, I like Pinnacle Entertainment as a company. I like what they've done
right.
as a company. I just don't particularly like their game, Savage Worlds. And there are problems with Palladium, but I like the fact that Palladium is a survivor, and you could knock them for not updating the system, but you can also admire that and saying, hey, this is what people have liked and played for a long time, so, you know, why mess with it?
Right.
And yeah, so I certainly respect that. So I do like the two companies involved and like them getting together. But yeah, certainly Savage Worlds is not enticing me to jump to the new Rifts. But if it had been Green Ronin, you know, because I do like the systems that they produce, and whether it was an existing system or whether they were going to make a system for it, or if Margaret Weiss Productions.
Yeah.
Had gotten the license, then I would be severely tempted to try the new Rifts and maybe even buy it sight unseen.
Wow.
But with Savage Worlds, I guess I don't really need to. I know what it is, sort of.
Right.
So.
Don't really need to, and I'm sure there's enough fans out there who will buy it.
Yeah, no, but good news. Yeah, and anything that draws more attention to Rifts, I guess, is good. Even though I get no money from it. Yeah.
Right. just want to clarify. Yep.
All right, well, in today's episode, we're going to talk about festivals, and this is inspired by Hanami, which means cherry blossom viewing or flower viewing, and there actually are cherry blossom festivals, but when we say Hanami, we mostly just think of people sitting under cherry blossom trees on a blue tarp and drinking and eating. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it could be a tree all by itself right next to a road, and they'll sit there on the tarp, so it doesn't have to be in a particularly picturesque setting.
Right.
Just needs a cherry blossom tree.
Now, I'm sure many people's image of, you know, Hanami before coming over to Japan is that, you know, yeah, it's this beautiful kind of site with, you know, lots of cherry blossom trees around, and everyone's kind of sitting there very nicely. And yeah, then you come to Japan and you're like, wow, you really do kind of set up a blue tarp anywhere and everywhere. There's a cherry blossom tree, whether it's a particularly beautiful tree or a particularly beautiful spot or not.
I remember one of our company Hanami's. There's a reasonably nice park near the office, but it doesn't have a whole lot of trees. Oh, it does have some cherry blossom trees, but first, I don't know who planted them. They planted them in the worst spot. One is on like a 90-degree incline, it seems.
Right, right.
And that's where they put the tarp, and you took off your shoes so you didn't step on the tarp, but if you had socks, you just slid right down.
Yeah, you pretty much did,
like, pretty much crawling up this hill, just sort of sit precariously on the tarp. Or they put them on sand, in the middle of, surrounded by sand, so that you have all these... And people think those are prime spots, I guess, because they're not on a huge incline. But they're just sitting on dirt.
Yep.
With a cherry blossom tree above them. Yeah. Yep.
We're really selling these festivals, aren't we?
Yeah. Yeah. And then just the sea of garbage
afterwards.
On the ground. Yeah. It's hard to walk. But yeah, that's wrapping up. So that got us thinking about the idea of festivals and how festivals appear in games. So a lot of times it seems that the adventure is set in a time around a festival. And you enter the town and it's the Moon Festival. And it means strangers from all over will be coming into the city or something like that.
Right.
So we just thought that was an interesting thing to explore.
No, that's a good point. Yeah, a lot of adventures are set during festivals or, you know, kind of the aftermath of a festival or gearing up towards a festival. Probably because, you know, I mean, the first thing I think of is that's a good place for like a murder mystery because, hey, there's a lot of people getting together and, you know, chance for mayhem and all kinds of stuff to happen. So, yeah. So we decided to break this episode into 5 parts, each part answering the question of why, when, where, what, and who. And kind of broke it down in the order that's probably, you know, most important or the thing you should think of first, though by no means do you have to do that. Some of the categories also overlap, usually the why and the when, because if you're doing a celestial or a seasonal festival, then the why and the when pretty much are the same thing.
And we'll try to draw examples from real festivals in history or festivals around us in Japan.
Which will all sound the same. So the first one was why.
Yeah, and we've mentioned one of the classic why is why do it, and it's to celebrate a seasonal change.
Hmm.
So cherry blossoms, they bloom around in spring. So when the weather starts to get nicer, so you go outside and you do that. There's also like harvest festivals, so you're kind of wrapping that up. So then you celebrate that change or the end of that hard work of bringing in the harvest.
Right. I mean, there's also kind of the I'm sure there's like a before because yeah, okay. The harvest festival you're celebrating the last harvest you brought in probably, or if it's during like the middle of the season, then yeah, you're celebrating all the harvest that you're bringing in. But I'm sure like before planting season, there's probably all kinds of festivals in different cultures to, you know, kind of get ready for the season.
Well, there could be the ones like to honor the god.
Mm, right.
And just to tie into the harvest, I mean, just the idea that you don't want to anger the gods. So you might do like some sort of festival with a ritual in order to ensure that the harvest will be plentiful.
Mm. Even after you bring in the first one, you know, I'm sure kind of so much of it would go to a specific god or, you know, you're kind of like, you know, thanking whatever deities you believe in for the first harvest you've brought in.
Yeah, I mean, one of the festivals that has lasted to modern times, or I guess it was started up again for modern times, the Olympics is there to honor Zeus.
Hmm.
So to honor the god and through, you know, athletic feats. Another Greek festival, the Dionysia, is there to honor the god Dionysus. And that had to do with like plays and like comedies and tragedies.
Hmm.
But again, like to honor the gods and to show respect. But there is also, I guess, a more material or more mundane reason to do it, and you know the Olympics is there for people to show their prowess and to compete in a non-violent way.
Mm, right.
The festivals to Dionysus, and there were other ones. There were ones that are just pretty much just drinking festivals, but they're there to entertain people. I mean, usually back in those time in ancient Greece, works of art like sculptures, plays, often like rich people would sponsor them.
Okay.
Or even like rich people would be playwrights because only like wealthy individuals would be able to take so much time off to organize a play. Mm. And I think in the Dionysia, each playwright had to do 3 plays for that festival and it was a competition.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. But I mean, the idea was art was for everybody and art was to entertain everybody. And I should mention that the Dionysus one was like an Athenian festival. And in Athens, the idea is like everybody sort of gets status by contributing to the, you know, the population, the collective as a whole.
Hmm.
Kind of related to the democratic ideal.
Right. Oh, that's good. Yeah. There's a couple ideas there because, yeah, you mentioning the tournament at the beginning or in the first book of, you know, Game of Thrones. And yeah, when you said that, I thought Okay, it's in addition to kind of providing entertainment and working as like a trade hub, it also is a place for non-lethal competition. Well, ideally non-lethal competition, you know, with the jousting and the melee and the, you know, the tournaments along that lines. And it was really interesting that there was the playwright the theater competition, essentially. I mean, I don't think I've ever heard of anyone doing that or inspiring a festival along those lines, like in a game. And sure, I'm pretty sure that combat and, you know, tournaments in terms of like jousting and melee are the first thing that would come to mind. But if you're doing this in a game, why wouldn't it be something else? Like, why couldn't it be, you know, spellcraft or, you know, theater craft, borrowing from the actual festival, you know, some other kind of competition that is not fighting?
No, that's a good point. I didn't think about like, yeah, a magic festival, like competition. And why would you do that? It could be, you know, it could be schools of magic just trying to raise their own prestige, so they all participate and organize these festivals in order to show their own prowess or to compete. And it can also be, when you're talking about the non-lethal competition, the festival could have been designed for people to let off steam.
Right. Okay.
And it could be a fun way, just to make it even more in-game, is it could be a fun way to have player versus player competition.
Right.
Without it getting nasty.
Hopefully, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're, you know, players, they might, you know, and there could be some antagonism in your game group, just to go a little bit meta. Mm. And you see it coming, and you don't want to end the campaign because people just aren't getting along, or there's some conflict. So you can just, okay, there's this festival right now, and it's for combat or whatever. It's like a jousting tournament or whatever the people do in your group, and you allow your players to fight it out.
Mm. Now, that could
be one way. That's a kind of a meta thing to do. But yeah, there's a lot of different things that you could do.
I like that. That might be kind of hard to maybe make fair. Okay, I guess we're getting a little bit into game terms here, especially if you're playing a game like Dungeons & Dragons or like pretty much any other game where the characters are going to be different from each other, where you have like that one spellcaster or that one, you know, bard, the one fighter, and you're like, okay, I have to have something where you guys compete against each other, but maybe it's got to be a series of competitions so that everyone can kind of shine in their little area, or I don't know, otherwise I kind of see it being difficult to make things fair, right? Because hey, of course the wizard is going to do, you know, gangbusters in the spellcrafting competition.
Yeah, I wasn't imagining like the wizard versus the fighter in a spell.
Okay, fair
spell enough, casting competition, and the fighter just kind of stands there. I mean, certainly you'd have to arrange it, and it doesn't necessarily have to be like in the fantasy. If you have like a superhero group, for some reason there's a festival or some sort of competition between the superheroes. I mean, there was a miniseries contest, The Champions, that came out.
Right.
It took place in a boxing ring.
Now, I was thinking that kind of building on the possible that there might be like, you know, kind of antagonism between the group, I think a competition at a festival like this could be a good way to bring characters and hopefully players together, because one of the things I was planning to do for the Changeling game that we ended before I did was there was going to be kind of like a big sports day, and kind of the Freehold was going to be divided at different teams, and I was going to have you three player characters be on one team with a couple of other NPCs to kind of show you the ropes. But I was going to try and find some way so that you would all work together. And if you have like a big group or like a group of characters that might not get along, I think a group competition like this would be a good way to have them in game kind of have to work together and show off their strengths and weaknesses. And I might do it fairly early in the campaign.
Yeah, and I think that was just one of our criticisms of the Changeling campaign, is that didn't occur earlier.
Right, right.
Because it sounded like a really good idea, and it was too bad that we never got to that.
Right, too little, too late. So, hey, learn from my mistake. Do it a lot earlier.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Or you look at the Battletech, and they have the clans, and they have different rituals. They're not festivals, per se, but they're competitions where they like fight in mechs. And the result of this competition is sort of your status, where you would place after you graduate. And again, you could do that again, like as teams, as a way to foster or to create the esprit de corps or comradeship.
Right, right, yeah. So it seems like we're focusing a lot on doing things or having competition as the kind of reason for the festival.
Well, I think the Olympics kind of kicked that off.
It did.
Dionysia, which is another competition. But one thing that we had mentioned prior, and maybe to bring back to the foreground, is the idea of status. And a lot of the Roman festivals were, why would they have it, was to show off a victory.
Okay.
So they would have like the triumph, and you would earn the right to do a triumph, but the general or the person that had earned that triumph would then have to fund it and spend all this money to entertain the people of Rome. But it's just the status. I mean, that would stay with you. And maybe it's hard to imagine in our modern times, but I mean, it's more than a Stanley Cup ring or a Super Bowl ring. Very few people would have earned one of these.
Right. Well, so. I guess it's maybe not exactly the same thing, but you kind of taking it to modern terms. Isn't, I guess, the equivalent of that the lavish parties celebrities throw, where it's kind of like, okay, fair enough. It's not because they went and pillaged something or won some great victory or anything like that, but it's more of a look at my status because I'm wealthy enough to have this musician or this band performing. I hired this cook, you know, to prepare the food you're eating, and we're having it here at whatever place, you know, the party is, which is possibly my house, and look at my house. And, you know, not exactly the same thing, but I definitely think those parties have taken over as, you know, showing off your status, and kind of the reason for a lot of those parties. I mean, you watch things like, you know, Gossip Girl and all those other similar shows. The reason for a lot of those parties are merely to show off your status.
No, absolutely. Yes and no. And I guess I certainly agree about the status thing and what you're saying, and that is the modern equivalent of it. One thing I don't want to be lost about the triumph example is that the fact that they had to earn it.
Mm.
And you could argue, using your example, is they earned it by just being wealthy or by getting in a coup of having U2 play at your party.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be like the king is having this festival. Why is he having this festival? Because he managed to get this famous whatever to appear.
Right. Famous bard. Yeah.
Yeah. But if you do the triumph, there's going to be a triumph because the king did X and is coming back. And that can cause some, I think it adds just an extra dimension to just a regular celebration, is that it's the result or a consequence of a recent event.
No, I definitely agree. And it's, like I tend to think that in games, a lot of times the player character's actions aren't recognized in game, right? Sure, you gain a level, or you get whatever mechanical bonuses you do for achieving that victory. Sometimes the game world reacts. I tend to think that the game world needs to react more often, and having to earn the triumph, and then having to pay for the party that you are expected to give afterwards adds kind of like a whole new dimension. It's like, well, okay, we just beat that, you know, that dragon. Look at all the gold we got from its hoard. Yeah, but think about how much is now going to have to go to throwing this massive party because it's expected of us.
It's expected of them, but they can also turn it down. So that would be an interesting conversation to have within that group, is we've earned the right to do this. Do we want to exercise the right? Or if you do it more as an obligation, like you're suggesting, then it's actually expected of us to do this. Do we want to not like disappoint the town? You would pretty much, by not having the triumph, erasing all the goodwill that you did by killing the dragon.
Right.
Because the people, after being terrorized by the dragon for X number of years, now want to have a party.
And you're denying them that party.
Yeah. So now, what's the reward? Just the normal life? They don't get that week-long party?
Right. No, I think that'd be really interesting, you know, trying to decide if you're going to do it. If so, how much you're going to spend, you know, all the kind of the logistics of, you know, bringing in these different entertainments and all this stuff. And of course, you wouldn't want to get like bogged down so that it becomes like nothing but a bookkeeping thing. But I could see that being fun, you know, trying to juggle not going broke with still providing enough of a celebration so that the, you know, you do not lose the goodwill of whatever city you just saved or whatever, you know, kingdom you just fought for because you threw a crappy party.
Yeah. Or you look at it, to just give a more futuristic example, if you look at Shadowrun and the corporation throws a party because they crushed another corporation, and during this festival party or whatever, you know, a murder happens, like you were talking about, like a lot of things can happen at one of these festivals, then the fingers might point to this other corporation. Like, you, because of it's this triumph, this festival is the result of this event, you might look to that event to see if people had motive to disrupt the festival.
Right. Wanting to disrupt the festival because you were on the losing end of that is pretty good motive.
Yeah. And I mean, we've talked about mysteries in the past, and there's certainly an excellent GURPS book about mysteries, called Mysteries, that explains, like, you know, here's how you build a mystery in a book, and you make it really difficult. And here's how you build a mystery in a game, you make it really easy.
Like, surprisingly easy.
Yeah, so, because you'd be surprised just how difficult the clues are. When you're playing a game, as opposed to when you're reading and then going back, that's what's happened. I mean, you have a protagonist to kind of hold your hand in the book. Here, you don't.
I think that was just the book's nice way of saying your players are kind of slow.
Right. To slow it down. Yeah, so something where you have a very obvious motive or something that would be a very obvious direction to go in a book is not so obvious in a game. Yeah, there's certainly other reasons to have festivals. Some of them are related to your children. You want them to have a safe and healthy future.
It's kind of a big thing here. There's
a couple.
Yeah,
Shichigo-san or 753 festival, and yeah, you can. And those are the ages of the children.
Right. I'll go off on a tangent, but it was interesting that you were supposed to take 7-year-old boys, 5-year-old girls, and 3-year-old girls, mm-hmm. you know, to kind of to the temple to get this kind of protection, because it was kind of believed that children were vulnerable to bad luck at certain ages. Interesting that girls had to go twice at different ages. Boys only had to go that one time.
No, it is interesting. I think it's just related to different parts of tradition of the samurai class and their rituals. So kids had to have their head shaved up until the age of 3. And then boys could wear hakamas, kind of like a kimono with pant legs, at 5. And then girls could start wearing an obi instead of a cord around their kimono at the age of 7.
Okay.
Next up is when, and we've already talked about probably the most important ones, the ones that are based around the season.
Oh, right.
Or the triumphs, which follow an event.
Or the birth of an important person, such as the firstborn son.
Yeah,
I did lump all that all together into why, didn't we?
Thank you. Good night.
Yep. Well, I mean, I can think of some other whens. Because, I mean, if you think about not harvest festivals, but I'm thinking like market festivals, right, in medieval Europe, then they just kind of happened when traders would show up. Or they were a set date so that everybody could get there at the correct time. You know? I mean, yeah, that might have been seasonal because you're going to produce things at different times of the season, but that wouldn't necessarily have to be the case. I mean, it could just be set, or, I mean, to turn into modern terms, hey, it's not exactly a festival, but like flea markets, third Sunday of every month, stuff like that.
Certainly that would add some flavor to the game, is that there's some, you mentioned why, or like you have the why, but also when, you know, oh, because it's the third moon of the third full moon of the year. And you're like, okay, right. that adds a little bit of color to this festival.
Hmm. Or like the kind of the big one in Japan, you know, Oshigatsu, the New Year's, which I guess kind of ties into the changing of the season. But I mean, it also happens the same time every year, like most festivals do. And it's just when, hey, beginning of the new year, so both seasonal and it's kind of important time-wise.
Maybe the other important thing to factor in there is when this festival is going on, everything shuts down.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not so much, the festival is almost like a trigger for what's going to happen around, as opposed to the festival is responding to something. It is dictating what happens.
No, that's a good point. Good point. Yeah. Now I'm thinking of where we mentioned before about, you know, Gen Con, if they did move, would choose a time that there wasn't another convention. And I remember thinking that, well, Gen Con is big enough where other conventions have to adapt to them. So that would be maybe a little bit off topic, but that would be kind of interesting if a festival had to be moved for whatever reason. Or it's just kind of like tied into the birth of someone important. And when that new, like a king or an emperor, and when a new person takes over, hey, presto, the festival is now a different day.
Yeah, we don't have a festival on the emperor's birthday, but the emperor's birthday is a national holiday.
Correct, yes.
So when you imagine when the emperor dies and the crown prince becomes emperor, then that national holiday is going to move. They'll create another one and just give the current emperor's birthday like a dumb name like Marine Day.
Right.
They already have a Marine Day, sorry.
They already do have a Marine Day, right, the first day you can go swimming. Yeah. I wonder if you think of all the emperors throughout Japanese history, and wouldn't there just be like, wouldn't every day be a national holiday if they went with that?
Like a Saint's Day, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
But, they're not, very few Saint's Days are holidays.
Right, I realize that. Yeah.
St. Patrick's, no. St. Valentine's, no.
St. Valentine's is a holiday.
No, it's not a national holiday.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Right.
But that's a good example of when is like the birth of not only somebody new, like the new heir, but also just, you know, when a famous hero or heroine died or was born, And that's when the festival is. It's based around, or some event in history.
Hmm. You center it around the birth or the death or the signing of something. And again, that would be, you know, another way to, I guess, commemorate in the game the death of a player character. Provided they died heroically and were well known, you know? I mean, it always kind of stings when...
Stabby McSteely, the third level rogue.
Or I'm thinking of Dungeon Crawl Classics with their zero level funnel, where everyone starts with like four characters, and by the end of that first adventure, just like so many of them have died, but the people who do make it out get to be first level. So yeah, none of them are getting a Saints Day or a festival day.
But
I've been watching season one of Vikings. And, you know, there's an important person dies, and there's like a big festival that goes on, a bit solemn at times because someone has died, but I mean, there is a lot of drinking and celebrating because, you know, the person's going on to supposedly a better place.
That made me think of a few things. One is the idea that the festival is so significant that things would change around it, or that everything stops when that festival comes into play. And we saw an example, and going back to another Greek festival, and if you watch 300, they make reference to it, the Carnia.
Oh, right, okay.
And just as far as the movie goes, or the actual historical event, is that when Leonidas is trying to raise a bigger army, but there happens to be a festival going on at that time, and it's so important that they won't respond until afterwards.
Right, right. It was, you know, it was kind of, yeah, it was in a sense that maybe this ties in with the why, because he couldn't raise the army because it was sort of, you know, forbidden to go to war during that time because it would anger the gods. Which gets into the why they were doing it, to honor the gods. And yeah, it was, I guess, immobile, where it's like, nope, you can't put this off, so you're not going to do it. And yeah, being in Japan where everything does shut down for certain holidays, like New Year's, yeah, you're just like, wow, everything is shut down. And so that is something, if the festival is important enough, that I think would happen.
So you can make it that the festival disrupts what the players are doing or their own actions, and they have to think of ways around achieving something that might be not simple but easier if the festival wasn't going on, and this is creating an additional challenge. The Olympics is another example where they would cease hostilities and even offer safe passage during that time just because it was so important. So when it happens, things around it change.
Again, that might get frustrating for players, or it could be really, kind of like a really cool non-combat problem to throw at them. It's like everything is shut down because of this festival, and certain things are not going to happen. Those things are normally what you would do, you know? So I guess to go a bit extreme, it's like, nope, you can't carry your sword, or you have to, you know, peace bond your sword or tie it up, or no, you can't do those things, or just people aren't really willing to talk to you because people don't really travel around this time, or even like, you know, New Year's here is like, that's kind of a time for family, at least the first couple days. So yeah, there's not going to be a lot of travel, and people aren't really going to be willing to talk to you because they're off doing their own thing.
Yeah. It could also provide a reprieve or a clock. A game clock. And what I'm thinking is, let's say you're doing World of Darkness and Vampire is a very political game, and they happen to have a particular festival that goes on. I mean, if it's old World of Darkness, it could be, I don't know, the birth of Cain. They somehow know and they celebrate that. And while that festival is going on, everything shuts down. And that means even like prosecution or some sort of like the court shut down. So maybe the players are in a difficult situation, but the courts have shut down, or the guard has shut down. It's just a skeleton crew. So they have, you know, 4 or 5 days, let's say, to prove their innocence, or to find the real killer, or to figure out a way to escape, or figure out some sort of solution to the problem.
Right, right.
Because this festival is going on. They might have the additional wrinkle of, you know, things are shut down and maybe they want to access them, but they have some breathing room. And it can also be a way, we mentioned earlier, it draws people into a central location. So you don't have to waste time traveling. They can access all the key players in your game world, and they're all there because for that festival.
Yeah, no, it's a good in-game excuse to have, all the major NPCs there in one location so that the player characters don't have to travel. But when you talked about everything kind of being shut down and, you know, them having a couple days of reprieve, I was thinking of modern U.S. Congress, where it seems to be, sometimes there kind of seems to be a push to get stuff done before the recess, and other times there doesn't seem to be, where, you know, the festival could be a game clock where, like, this festival is going to happen in 5 days' time. and you know the city is going to shut down and pretty much no one's going to want to do anything. So you have until the festival starts to solve this problem or figure it out, you know? Or it acts like a game clock where, hey, you know, the judge, the king, whoever, they're going to want to wrap up proceedings in time to start the festival. So you have to get that stuff done now. And the longer you go on, the more reluctant people are going to be to start something. Or maybe the more hasty judgment people are going to have just because they want to wrap things up before the Christmas holiday, essentially.
No, I like how you flip, the clock, you have it where the clock could be the festival, or the clock could be the time leading up to the festival.
Right.
Yeah. Going back to when we were talking about festivals recognizing significant people or significant events, that's a good way to infuse history into your game world, or to remind people that you do have a history in this game world. And it reminds people, maybe they didn't know about it before, but now that there's a festival, it's a way to introduce bits of history to the players, and the world feels and the setting feels more alive.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's one of the things that festivals do. It makes the game world feel more alive.
Yeah. So if I were to run 13th Age again and run it, I mean, in the default setting, yeah, I might have it a few years after our last campaign and then have, you know, a festival that references the great battle that happened there.
Right, and Chris's character would be nowhere in it.
Oh, yeah. The traitor.
Tell me, baby. Yeah. Well, you mentioning, you know, the commemorating a great battle, that leads us to the question of where. You know, where do festivals take place? And I think that, at least sometimes, having the festival at the location of that climactic battle would be pretty appropriate.
No, that's a good point. Like some sort of mecca. Or a pilgrimage could be a way to start, you know, a journey instead of, so rather than having a merchant asking the party to escort him or her to this other city, it could be some sort of festival that's going to take place, you know, at a city, an important point, very central location, and now the party needs to travel there. It could be, you know, this science fiction, it could take place at a particular planet. And if you talk about like this galactic empire intergalactic empire, I don't know. And that can seem so huge. How do you bring it in? Is that there's a big festival going on in
whatever sector.
Yeah, on this planet, and the people got to travel there. And that's a way for people that are in this far, you know, across the galaxy to come together and to have those coincidences that make for great stories.
No, I like that. And yeah, I think that's a good start to an adventure, you know, instead of going to this place because of, you know, whatever reason, you know, or a bad reason, the reason is there's a festival and everybody goes to this place to commemorate this thing that happened in this place. And the place is just as important as the event that happened there. I guess kind of the flip side of that is when we were talking about, you know, Hanami here in Japan, and the location there is important because you need cherry trees.
Mm-hmm.
But there are multiple locations for the same thing because there are cherry trees all over Japan.
That's a good point. And you have, it creates like mini festivals everywhere.
Right. So yeah, instead of one big central location, it's this kind of dispersed festival, and everyone is doing relatively the same thing and around the same time and for the same reason, just in multiple locations all across whatever setting you're playing in.
No, I like that. I think in both cases, the location is really, really significant, but in very different ways. And if you take a thing like Thesmophoria, which is the festival for the goddess Demeter.
Okay.
And her daughter
Persephone,
yeah. They would have like a sacred space, and on the first day, they would have to go to that sacred place. So just that idea, like if it was on top of a hill, that the first part, it's just getting there, and the festival only takes place in this one sacred spot.
Right, well, that's a way to make, I guess, kind of unify a campaign world, the idea that this festival is happening all over the place, but at multiple locations, and pretty much the same way and at the same time, but maybe there are slight cultural differences, and I could see that being, well, I use the word interesting far too often, but that could be interesting to the player characters, where, you know, they pretty much know what's going to happen, but then you can introduce differences in culture through this festival, because they already have a baseline for what should happen, and things are happening slightly differently.
Yeah, I like that. It's a way to reinforce similarities, but also differences. And sometimes similar things happening in different cultures can actually reinforce the differences between those cultures.
Right.
It also gives the players perhaps enough similarities in which to maneuver in this environment, but still create, you know, or still have the chance for certain faux pas or, you know, cultural snafus.
Right. No, yeah. I do like that. Yeah.
And I like the idea of, you know, if you're having this one, let's say everywhere there's this cherry tree, or every city has it, and what they do is they kind of build a kind of a shrine, or they choose the highest point, and that's where the festival will take place. So there's always like a really strong image that's associated with that festival.
Okay.
Yeah. So when they go into the town, they kind of look and they say, okay, so this festival will take place on that hill.
Right. You can recognize, I imagine, that thing for the festival location. Yeah. Yeah.
Other examples might be, I mean, this is not set in stone, but if you look at the Hanabi, you know,
fireworks. Yep.
Yeah. Fire flowers or fireworks. They tend to set up all the festival stuff around the river.
Right.
Because usually they'll set up on the river or by the river, like the people that are doing the fireworks, so you get the best view on the river. So you're looking at different geographical locations in which to have the festival.
Well, I like that too.
Maybe geographical locations is a bad word, but geographical features might be a better way to put it.
Okay.
Since geographical location would just be a location.
right. Sorry. But I mean, to be fair, rivers do have a location, but I know what you mean.
Yeah.
But no, so far, I think I've at least assumed that the game master or the person running the game would be creating the festival, possibly with player input, only because the game master is usually the person who runs everything else outside the player characters. But if, and this goes back to your idea of the triumph and having to sponsor a festival, if the players had a lot more input into, you know, putting the festival together, then again, choosing a location for the festival could possibly be an maybe exciting or at least different kind of, I guess, problem for them to tackle. Where it's like, okay, you'd have to think of the what and the when, and now you have to think of the where. Like, if you are doing fireworks, like, you know, Hanabi, then, hey, okay, a river would probably be a decent place. Or, you know, you want it somewhere central enough that people can get to, but, you know, depending on the type of the festival, maybe not smack dab in the center of town if you're doing some kind of, like, firework display or you know, fire jumping thing.
Yeah, I guess that would be a pretty important consideration.
Right.
And that brings us to what do you do? And we've touched on a few things. Hey, watch fireworks.
Right.
Different displays.
If you're going to a Japanese festival, walk up and down the street of little vendors selling the same kind of snack food and, yeah, spend more money than you would normally.
Well, food is so important to just about every festival.
In Japan, yeah.
Yeah, the one we mentioned about for the goddess Demeter, they eat meat on one of the days. I think it's the last day, the third day. Our meat was really rare in Greek society. Like, what I read was that they had animal sacrifice, but one of the great things about the animal sacrifice, I mean, you think, hey, that's a waste of a good cow.
Mm.
But that was one of the few times that most people would get to eat meat, is when they would sacrifice the animal.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You mean for this festival or just in general?
In general, yeah.
Okay.
So meat was really rare in their diets. So the times that they would eat meat tended to be around festivals or rituals like sacrifice.
I could see that, maybe a bit of a tangent, but it's like, yeah, you're spending all this money for this sacrifice. And I mean, apart from the idea of wasting this expensive thing that you have purchased, I could see how it would be offensive to whatever god you were sacrificing to just let this thing go to waste, maybe, you know? So like, nope, we're going to use it and we're going to consume it. Of course, I guess the flip side of that is leaving offerings for deities, which you then don't eat, you know? Which actually kind of happens here a little bit, where, you know, for New Year's, you make mochi, make the mochi cakes, and then you kind of set up that little pyramid of three cakes. And it's not exactly the same thing, because I don't really think anyone believes that, you know, these cakes are going to be eaten by anyone, but it's still food you put out.
Well, it's for the spirits, and you put those, if you have like a little shrine in your house. It's very Shinto. You would put the food in front of your ancestors or their ancestors' pictures. But yeah, what I found out, I mean, you will then eat the food yourself.
Usually, yeah.
Yeah.
In the case of the mochi cakes, you just wait for them to get kind of dry and hard.
Yeah, I don't eat those. But I do know that the Japanese side of my family, they would put out, you know, the rice and that. And then, you know, after it's sat there for an appropriate amount of time, then they put it back into the rice cooker for people to eat.
Right.
So yeah, definitely food plays a big part. We talk about the Olympic Games. What do? They engage in different competitions. Actually, Greece had a few different drama festivals.
Oh, really? One wasn't enough.
No. think one focused more on comedies and one focused more on tragedies, but they each festival had both.
Okay. I guess kind of like modern-day film festivals.
Yes. Yep, modern-day film festivals. So it's a way to, what do they do? They would showcase what they have. So you were talking about like the setting up a festival when the merchants or the traveling merchant would come by. So what do they do? Then that's the time to buy things, things that they might not have. I mean, in your Changeling game, you had that market.
Right, right.
Where you could buy very, the Goblin Market, buy very exotic things. But then you could make it where, you know, it's a festival and this is the only time to buy stuff.
Well, that's...
certain things, not buy things in general, but certain
things. I knew what you meant. Yeah, yeah. I could see, especially if you were running a campaign in some world that had trade routes or caravan routes, you know, fantasy or science fiction, whichever. I'm sure different, merchants would come along at different times just because whatever world or whatever site you're harvesting these materials from are, you know, different distances away, and so it takes the caravans more or less time to get there. So I could see, for example, you know, some kind of iron celebration, you know, when the iron ore merchants show up, or, you know, the tinsmith festival, just because of the types of merchants who would show up or the types of, you know, travelers or salesmen who would show up. And that's, I guess it's kind of similar now to trade shows. You know, you have like agricultural trade shows, technology trade shows, and, you know, all those different kind of things. And they generally attract the same type of, you know, businesses because that's what people want to go see.
Yeah. Well, Gen Con, Comic Con.
Yep. Yep.
Those are Comic Con. Nerd festivals. Comic Con probably more of a trade show for movies these days.
Okay.
Than comics, if it ever was a trade show for comics. And Gen Con is definitely a trade show for game companies. I mean, that's when they try to roll out big releases. It's either August or Christmas.
Right, right.
Oh, and if they're not going to release anything in August, they'll certainly make an announcement that, hey, you're going to be able to get something by Christmas.
Right.
So I wouldn't be surprised if we see Pinnacle will be at Gen Con and Palladium.
Oh, right.
Advertising that there's going to be, or promoting the new Savage Rifts that's going to come out in Christmas. But yeah, it's a festival of role-playing and nerddom, but it's also, a trade show. And that's what it is. I mean, whatever is valuable in your society, that could be, you could build a festival around it. And it's like, you can only get this here at this point in time.
Yeah.
Other things could be like the Tanabata Festival, the Star Festival.
Oh, right.
In Japan, where it's about making wishes and romantic aspirations, I guess. And you would do that on like strips of colored paper and hang those up without other ornaments. And when you go to places like one of the northern cities, Sendai, and they do a lot around this festival, then you'll just see like strips of paper everywhere. Or, I mean, strips of paper are probably underselling it, but like these colorful banners that all offer wishes, you know, businesses have them. So, I mean, that's one thing that you could do is how the festival looks. Like, what do you do and how does that influence how this festival will look?
Right.
Now, and we've talked about, you know, prepared text, box text for your game, but I mean, this is certainly something, if you're going to have a festival, it's certainly worth preparing how you're going to present the visuals to the players.
No, and I'm glad you brought that up, because what happens at the festival will affect what it looks like and kind of what people are doing. And yeah, one of the festivals here in Japan, in Osaka, is the Kishiwada Danjiri Festival. And for people, I think I went gone to that like the first 2 years I was here. And part of the reason I went was because the people who lived in the area were playing up or telling me how dangerous this thing was, because it's just groups of guys who race around the city with these wooden shrines on wheels, essentially. And these things are massive and huge, and there's people dancing on them, and corners of buildings get wrapped up in protective stuff. I mean, like light poles are wrapped up in foam just because of the accidents that have happened because of this thing. And when I was, both times I was a little bit disappointed because nothing really exciting happened, which I suppose is good, because that would mean, you know, something fell over and broke. But, I mean, shops are closed down again. Not that windows are boarded up, but the city or the neighborhood is protected against possible accidents, and it really does affect the way things look.
Yeah, I mean, the classic dangerous festival, Running of the Bulls in Spain.
Okay, yep.
Yeah, another festival that I participated, I didn't participate in the Running of the Bulls, but one that I participated in Germany, and the first time against my will, was Fasching. And what did they do is they parade with these colorful masks, and each town has its own mask, mm-hmm. often like a wooden mask, and they parade, and then they have witches that are in this festival, or like people dressed up as witches, and then they kidnap kids.
Okay.
Or capture kids, and they put them in these little, like a jail that's on a, okay. on a float, and then the parents won't get the kid back until the end of the parade. And they took me, and my mom was not familiar with this tradition, so it was like chasing the parade, trying to get me back, so...
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, and I was scared of clowns for okay. years afterwards.
It's even funnier now.
So there's an example of something that people do at festivals, and that's dress up. And there's examples in ancient Greece. There's also examples in Italy. I think in Venice.
Okay.
Yeah.
Kind of think of like an image in my mind is kind of like a masquerade ball a bit now. I'm also thinking of the yeah. Mummers Day Parade.
Oh, Philadelphia has that, yeah.
Where the what is, well, I mean, regular people kind of just get drunk out in the street watching the mummers perform, but if you're in one of those clubs, then yeah, you dress up and you've been working for a long time on this costume, and you get drunk too, and mm-hmm. yeah.
And there you go. Another thing people do at festivals is drink.
Right, to excess.
Yeah, but that could be a way to encourage players to drink, and maybe they might do something different. They might play their character a little bit differently.
Oh, you mean you're talking completely meta and where the player is drinking because
No. Characters... I mean, they could if they want, but I mean...
Okay.
Sorry, I should have said the characters drink. Yes.
I see what you mean.
And then the players play their characters differently.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like, I could see that. Yeah, because again, like way back at the beginning, we talked about, you know, festivals are kind of good opportunities to have things happen. And hey, as much as people drink during festivals, or as much as, you know, festivals are kind of centered around drinking, getting drunk and doing something you probably wouldn't, or taking advantage of people who are drunk, either, you know, politically or whatever, would be a good kind of adventure or plot hook.
Oh, I like that. And bring it up to modern times, future times. You got like Shadowrun or a World of Darkness game, and you want to get information or to create a scandal around a prominent figure, mm-hmm. and this festival is the time to do it.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, copious amounts of sex happen in certain festivals. So
Some festivals are devoted to that, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And so if your players are comfortable with that, then their characters can engage in that, and that could be a lot of fun. It might be a different way to play the game. And it could be a good way to introduce something maybe a little bit sensitive, or maybe something that you're not sure if the players will be comfortable doing.
Because it's a one-time deal?
Yeah, it's a one-time deal. You see it, and if they had a lot of fun doing that, then you're like, okay, so we'll include this more in the game.
And by the way, did I mention this festival happens every week?
Yeah, and the festival again, yeah. But if it turns out the players aren't that comfortable playing it, or they don't have very much fun playing like sexual situations, then it's done. The festival's done. It's not like the game failed. They had the festival. Festival's over. Let's move on.
Right. And hey, if your campaign lasts long enough, if it gets around to a year again, your players know, or your characters know, to not be in whatever city it is.
Yeah, and that's the time to play up. That's the time to play up the location.
Right.
Yeah. And there's a cherry blossom tree. Run from the cherry blossom tree.
We turn around and leave. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a street filled with cherry blossom trees. So, and that brings us to the last question to ask when you're making a festival or having a festival in your game, and that's who
is everybody.
He was participating, yeah. And here's something interesting about Athens that I learned is that there were so many festivals or, you know, religious days that roughly about half of the year was devoted to festivals and religious days.
Oh, really?
To the point where, like a worker or a laborer in their contract, it would dictate how many of these days they could take off. Hmm. Which you can imagine in modern times is just how many days off do you get? How many paid holidays do you get?
Right, right.
But they would build it around these special days because these were a break from the monotony. Hmm. So in that case, like a lot of the people would participate. But if you're, when we're talking about Thesmophoria, that festival, the one for the goddess Demeter.
Oh, right.
That was only open to married women. They were the only ones that could participate. And married women, not unmarried women. They couldn't participate and men couldn't participate.
Right. Another thing about, you know, stipulating when you could take days off, or kind of there being so many, you know, festival days that you only got so many of them off, kind of reminded me of, you know, modern day Japan, where it seems like, you know, every week there's kind of a, well, maybe not that much frequency, there's a national holiday. But I like the idea of restricting who participates just because it makes things different. like you said, okay, this festival is only married women. This festival is only unmarried women. This festival is, you know, boys that are 7 years old or you know, 5 years old or however old. Of course, you wouldn't have to do anything, I guess, all that mundane if, you know, in a campaign setting. But rather than having the festivals for everybody and anyone, I think restricting it, yeah, gives it a little bit more, not depth, but that would be a good way to highlight the different groups in your campaign setting or in your story.
Yeah,
because
that
if
would
they're
be
important
good.
Enough, you know, I'm sure they all have festivals. Like, how many pantheon or how many gods are in the D&D pantheon and how many temples are there? I'm sure they all have their own festival days and trotting them out and showing off kind of what they do would be a good way to say, this is what this group is about. In case players weren't familiar with it.
Right. Or it could be a different race. Like, this is a dwarven festival, which may or may not be open to other races.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's like St. Patrick's Day and everybody's an honorary dwarf on Dwarf Day.
Yeah, kiss me, I'm dwarvish.
Right.
That's a good example, yeah. Yeah. Or, and it could, I mean, you can have the sort of semi-segregation, you know, where only the vendors and the performers are all dwarves.
Mm.
But, you know, other races could come and buy food or watch the spectacle, but none of them can participate fully in the festival. And then you can also combine it with the triumph idea of, or even like the special days that commemorate people. But who can participate in this festival? Only people who have done a certain thing.
Mm. Okay, yep.
Yeah, and that can be a way to make the players feel a little bit special because they were able to do that certain thing or to encourage them to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking the negative where it's like your players' characters are seeing these other people being part of the celebration. It's like, well, why do they get that? Well, they did this thing. And that can be that extra, you know, impetus or motivation to like, we want some of that or we want our characters to be recognized that way. So let's go do that thing. You know?
Or, I mean, something to fake. I mean, some games have disguise skills and undercover skills.
Mm, right.
So it could be a nice way to reward a player that has those or to encourage the players to try to play that type of game is, oh, you can only participate in this festival if you are this or you have done this and the players haven't or aren't. So then they would need to fake that in order to infiltrate the festival. And I don't know if it's an extreme example, but maybe... You know, a classic example might be where the man infiltrating the...
Married Women Only Festival?
The Thesmorphia Festival.
Right.
Wow, I should have picked one with an easier name as an example. Yeah.
No, I think that is a classic example, you know, and yeah, that is a way to reward, you know, the character or the player whose character has disguise skills. And I mean, if you tie it to
or
kind
the player
of things,
that's a married woman, yeah.
Or the player that's a married woman, yeah, I guess.
They get in.
Right. No, I was thinking if you tie that to kind of like the what happens and, you know, maybe there's certain kind of, that plays up the mystery, right? Like if you've never been to this festival, you know, for whatever reason, because you're not invited and you have to infiltrate, well, then you don't know what you're going to be in store for behind these kind of closed doors, or if there's some kind of, you know, jousting tournament where the person who is disguised now has to participate in this tournament, well, okay, you know, that's kind of a way for the game master to throw him a bit of a curveball, which could be fun or not, depending on what happens.
Oh, I like the secret thing. You know, this is related to the goddess Demeter, and it's not a festival. It's one of the mystery cults. It's the Eleusinesium Mysteries.
Sticking with those hard to pronounce names, I see.
Eleusinesium Mysteries. But I read that there's some sort of secret that they get when they complete the initiation ceremony, and nobody knows the secret to this day. So
really?
if somebody's revealed the secret, it never got written down anywhere or passed along outside of this cult. So they really kept that secret. So,
wow,
yeah, I thought that was
cool.
Interesting. Yeah. So no one really knows what it was. So maybe, yeah, somebody's got to find out. So you have to infiltrate this cult or this, but let's make it attached to the episode, this festival,
right,
and find out what it is.
Yeah.
All right, well, that wraps up our episode on festivals. It's just something that we see going on around us, and we thought, you know, this might be really fun to have in a game, not necessarily sitting under a cherry blossom tree and a blue tarp
drinking beer.
Drinking beer or brown rice nihonshu. I recommend it. Actually, I just recommend the one type because I haven't tried any others. But certainly how you do a festival can make a big difference in the game. So it's just a few questions to ask yourself when you're creating a festival, or a few questions like you mentioned earlier, Wayne, is to ask your players.
Right.
You know, tell me about this festival. And there's certainly certain systems out there and games out there that would really allow the players to contribute to the festival as it's going on and adding to its history.
Right. No,
and
I
its
like
practices and traditions, yeah.
Right. And if you feel we miss any important festivals, or if you have any questions about festivals here in Japan, then you can direct all of those questions and comments to Chris. Take it away.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us again on Out of Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, outofredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher, or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can plus one us on G+. You can like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter, or you can join up and talk to us in our forums. Those are at idleredhands.com/forums and are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. Or you can send us an email at info@idleredhands.com.
Thanks a lot, and bye.
Bye.
Drive-Thru RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive-Thru RPG. The one true source for RPGs.
Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.